The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. Hey everyone, I'm Sarah Edmondson.
Hi, I'm Anthony Ames, Sarah's husband, aka Nippy.
And we're here to talk about things that are just a little bit culty. We were in a cult and we woke up, and it was all captured in a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, also in my memoir, Scarred.
And then we made this podcast. I guess you could say we're technically a cult show now.
But not your typical cult show. We're not so much about the grisly details. We are about kicking the doors down on the shame and the secrets that make these culty things so destructive.
We're here to have frank conversations about how cool things can cross over into the cultiverse. How to spot trouble when you see it, and what happens when it comes to recovering from something culty, if that happens to you.
Each week, we'll call on experts, advocates, fellow survivors, and whistleblowers to help us unpack what's going on in the cultiverse.
We're here to share what we know on everything from red flags to resiliency, and to have a few laughs along the way, because sometimes you gotta laugh.
Thank God. Now, we have a lot to cover, so let's get this show rolling, shall we? A Little Bit Culty Season 2 drops new episodes every Monday on the Acast app or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And to learn more, visit us on Instagram or at alittlebitculty.com.
All right, here we are. Final episode of 2021.
It's been a year.
It hasn't even been a year. We started in February of this year, and this is episode 24. We did 24 in 10 months, but I was just pumping our tires. We did 24 in 10 months.
I thought you weren't allowed to pump your own tires.
No, our tires.
Well, I'm excited about this episode. I'm not hungover because I only had one glass of champagne, but I ate too much cheese last night.
That's what that was.
Jeez. I mean, nursing a cheese hangover. That's a good story. Okay. Yeah.
Way to kick off our final episode there, Sarah.
This is the last episode of 2021. We were going to share our highlights and our lowlights in the Edmondson Ames household. What was the highlight of your year, sweetheart?
The highlight of my year?
Yeah.
I would say this, and it's not so much one moment as much as, remember when we were at our New Year's dinner last year? And someone said like one sentence, and I said, turn attitude into gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I made, I think, the comment on when we were on the Mormon podcast about how to enjoy the present, not leave and, you know, go to the future or the past or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'd say it's accumulation of just having a moment where I had this awareness where I'm re-owning and reimagining my life, my dreams in a way that I hadn't since before we were, you know, going down this journey of quote personal growth. I'm claiming what the things that I wanted to do beforehand that I thought this thing, and I'm starting to make strides and achieve that in certain areas. And it's reaffirming in a way, and it's a reaffirming in a way that only a time thing can do, right? Like you can adjust your psychology, take responsibility for the things in your psychology that are rooted in entitlement and things that are limiting you. But then you need a time lag of like however long it takes for that psychology to be applied to the world, the laws of cause and effect, whatever you're doing, and then to experience the confirmation that it's been done. And then you have to recognize that's what's caused it. So there's a whole process that I went through of like just going, bam, I did that.
Mm-hmm. And that things are better.
Yes, better and thriving. And I kind of feel like, you know, I feel like I'm in the gym and I'm seeing my results a little bit, to use that the gym metaphor. So that to me has been the most affirming thing of this year.
Do you remember when we first got out and we had that friend of ours, and when we were down in LA, we were still, you know, deep in trauma. And he was like, you're going to get better. 6 months from now, you'll look back and you'll realize that things are better. And then another 6 months, things are better. And it's true. And it was really supportive and helpful. And I think I've passed on that message, like, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel, but when you're in it, it's really hard to see that. It just feels like, you know, it's sort of, again, one of my favorite, this too shall pass. Quotes.
And that goes for the good times too.
Stay in it.
Also, like, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention some of the trauma that, or some of the adversity that my family's gone through a little bit. There's been death, You know, I lost two friends from high school. Someone in my family died that was young. So, you know, it's been a blend. And I think the middle of your life, you start to see more of that.
What about resolutions?
You're not really calling those resolutions, are you? I'm going to do the no sugar thing. No sugar.
I'm not really ready to do that. I mean, I kind of do low sugar, but there's...
We'll start tomorrow.
We'll see. I feel like this has been a really positive year in terms of like recognizing I like to produce. I like to make something, you know, and not be waiting for other people to invite me or audition for their projects. I really like making this podcast. I'm so grateful for everyone who's in our team for making this podcast amazeballs. Our listeners for all their support. You know, we went from this being, oh, let's do a little podcast in our living room to, you know,
let's do it in separate rooms.
Now we're in separate rooms for tech. But that is actually one of my resolutions, by the way. I want to have a podcast set up proper with like nice chairs. And maybe we'll aim for it in season 3 or season 4. Corp chairs, yes. Video setup and, you know, like maybe getting some visuals. And well, we have some exciting announcements. We'll save that for the next episode to share with you what's coming in 2022. But really, like, we couldn't have done this without Karis and Will at Citizens of Sound and Jess Tardy, our amazing co-producer, who's like such a, I don't even know, how do you put Jess in a descriptive?
There's no words for that.
There's no words for Jess. She's the reason we have A Little Bit Culty. She pitched us the title and we said, yeah, we want to work with you.
Listen,
and
the here two we people are. Listening to this, Will and Jess and Karis, I say it to Sarah every time. We had some dark and they're the light that showed up. We didn't even know it. They had to convince us they were in the light. And they were like, oh, yeah, that's right. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. And our partnership with Acast to help us take this pod to the next level, which has been really exciting. And more of that to come in the new year.
Yes. Announcements coming.
So our guest today, Patrick Ryan, is what you could call a master of the cultiverse. He's a graduate of the Maharishi International University, a former associate teacher of transcendental meditation, and has been a cult intervention specialist since 1984.
He also founded TMX, an organization of ex-members of transcendental meditation.
His cult expert credentials are very impressive, especially about TM, obviously. And sidebar, I had so many friends acknowledge that I'd gotten out of a cult who were still in TM, not recognizing that's also a cult. But we'll get to that.
He established the International Cultic Studies Association online resource. He contributed to the Cult Observer, and he's the co-author of Ethical Standards for Thought Reform Consultants.
He's also earned a metric shit ton of distinctions for his work and service, like the AFF Achievement Award, the Leo J. Ryan Distinguished Service Award, and a Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Cultic Studies Association.
He's a baller.
Pat Ryan is a baller. I also wanted to point out that Cult News 101, the site that Pat publishes with Joe Kelly, is key to how we keep tabs on what's going on in the cultiverse every week, every day, actually. All three sites that they publish are really a gigantic library of resources, cultnews101.com, intervention101.com, cultmediation.com. And we'll put those in our show notes.
All right, let's get to it. Here's our convo with Patrick Ryan.
Pat, thank you so much for joining us. I know we've been chatting about this for a while, and it, of course, is a natural fit that you would be a guest on A Little Bit Culty.
It's my pleasure.
Since you are such an expert in the field. And for our listeners who don't know, we'd love to hear a little bit about your story, about how you got into TM, to transcendental meditation. Just to also say that we tend to focus on cults that are current, but this is a cult that has been around since the 70s and still in operation.
Yeah, it's been actually around since the late 50s.
Oh, wow.
And it's very active through the David Lynch Foundation now worldwide.
Interesting.
Especially in South America for some reason. Yeah, so I got involved when I was in high school. So it was a long time ago. I was 17. Maharishi appeared on the Merv Griffin Show with Burt Reynolds, Mary Tyler Moore, Grandma Walton, Clint Eastwood, and talked about TM. And when that happened, it was in January, February of 1975, 40,000 people started being initiated or taught TM a month. after that television show. So I was in high school and I wrote for my high school newspaper and I was part of a junior achievement company with the St. Petersburg Times. And so the editor suggested that I go write a story about this. So my high school actually had a TM club.
Wow.
TM was taught in the public school systems of California, Kansas, and New Jersey. It was sort of a very sanitized group at that time. So when I walked into the introductory lecture, the guy who was giving it was the guy who taught athletes to meditate. So Larry Boa was there. Pete Rose, I think, was not there, but he had just learned. So it was kind of, you know, sort of wild for a 17-year-old kid to go in and all of a sudden being impacted by these people. So I signed up and learned. And so I was young. Most of the teachers were in their 30s, 25, 30. I ended up being encouraged to go on a week-long course, and they offered actually to pay for it for me.
How'd you earn that?
I was sort of volunteering at the center. I took a couple of advanced courses. You know, I was a good recruit. I was there doing the things, putting up posters, advertising the things that they wanted you to do. And I got a lot of people involved. So my parents were a little concerned. So they brought me to the priest, my Irish Catholic family, and I got him involved. And they had me talk to a friend who was a therapist, and I got her involved. And everybody they had me talk to, I got involved. So you know, it was just, I was just a good salesman as a kid.
They're recruiting you.
They were.
So when you say taught you how to meditate, like, is this like a 10-minute thing, a half an hour thing, hour? What were you doing? What did the classes or look like? What was that about?
TM is taught in a 7-step system. So there's an introductory lecture, a preparatory lecture, and then an interview with the teacher. And then on a Saturday, you bring fruit, 2 to 3 pieces of fruit, 6 to 12 flowers and a white handkerchief, and your fee. And at that time, it was $55. Now it's a couple thousand. You don't know what's going to happen. They tell you to take your shoes off, and all these things that you brought are put in a basket, and you're led into a very dim-lit room, and there's a picture of a guru, and it's filled with incense and candles, and the teacher asks you to stand before this kind of altar, and they start singing this song, and it sounds like apavitro, pavitro, va, sarva, it's not, you don't know the language. So it's really a conversion, like an initiatory rite to Maharishi's brand of Hinduism. And so doing that, then the teacher turns to you and, like, without you knowing it, starts whispering a word, a mantra to you, which has been selected for you, for your personality. So it was Ima. And I was like, and they just kept on asking you to repeat it, and then stop repeating it verbally.
What was your first mantra?
Ima.
What does that mean?
It's called a Bija mantra. It's a seed of the goddess Saraswati, the goddess of learning. It's a seed mantra that they're called. And the idea is that it somehow it invokes the qualities of that deity. No, it's not explained that way. This is explained in scientific terms. There's no deities involved in any of those things.
How'd you feel when this is going on when you were young? Did you feel it was weird? Did you have any red flags?
They actually, during the ceremony, they asked me to bow down on the floor, and the teacher bowed down and I didn't. There was a point in the ceremony where they took a stick of incense, and they put it in a candle, and the incense lit up. And then there was a little thing of rice, and they touched the rice, and the rice started burning. And they started waving their burning rice around. I'm like, is this like, I didn't know that rice would burn. I had no idea really what was going on. So it was a little weird, but the people that were in the class with me, there was the guy who was, an orthopedic surgeon. They were all like, sort of upstanding people. And there was
a
TM person in my high school. But as I've advanced a little bit, by maybe June of that 1975, I learned March 1st, 1975. I had already seen Maharishi once at an event. So they encouraged me to go to this week-long course, called a residence course. And this is where, instead of meditating, I meditate twice a day for 17 minutes because I was 17. You started increasing the amount of meditation to 2 or 3 times in the morning, 2 or 3 times in the evening, and you added yoga and breathing exercises to it. But the person who was running the course was Mia Farrow's sister, Prudence Farrow, who the song, Dear Prudence, Won't You Come Out and Play, is written about. And so, she took a liking to me and she said, there's this university where you can go to, the Maharishi International University, where you can become a TM teacher and have all your academics. And she sold me that I should go to the school. So I went home and I told my parents that I was not going to the University of Florida, that I would be going to Maharishi U. That didn't go over too well initially. Yeah, my dad was a very high-ranking military guy from South Dakota. you know, who rode a horse to school, you know, and then he has his son who, you know, is all fun in La La Land. They came to realize that they were either going to go along with it
or lose you
or lose me. And so they chose to go along with it. And they were very skillful in, my mom joined the Parents Association. So if you were concerned about your kid going to the school, my mother would be one of the people you could talk to. So they got very involved in making sure they had a finger on the pulse of what was happening with me.
You know, in retrospect, what do you think was the main thing that really hooked you? Was it at, you know, when you first started seeing your peers and people that you admired meditating? Like, how did they get you, and what did you think you were signing up for?
Well, I was signing up for developing my full potential. So they told the story that Einstein said that you only use 10% of your mental potential, which is not accurate. And that this would help you develop your full potential.
Right.
It was all about improving, athletic improvement, grades, blood pressure. You could run faster. I mean, anything that is good, it did. and because I was surrounded by people that were, you know, there were people in society that were sort of, you know, you're taught to respect, which were physicians, you know, newspaper people, teachers at school. And it was a different time, the 70s, than it is now. You know, this was the height of the human potential movement.
Right.
So it wasn't that strange. And it was taught in the public schools. Mia Farrow's sister, Prudence, convinced me I should go. And I remember loading up my Volkswagen and driving from Florida to Fairfield, Iowa. And about 2 or 3 days before I left, the teachers told me that, you know, you have to wear a suit at the school and it's vegetarian food. And that was the first time I even heard any of this, that there are vegetarians. And then you had to wear a suit and tie to classes, to dinner, to lunch.
Why?
Because Maharishi wanted people to, you were supposed to wear a blue suit, white shirt, red tie. You bought your clothes at Brooks Brothers or at Barney's in New York. It was to show an image of professionalism. You were actually instructed at one point to throw any blue jeans you owned into the Atlantic Ocean. everything changed. So I go there and, you know, I'm a Florida kid that grew up on the beach. You know, ties? It's not. So my father tied a bunch of ties for me. And then I, you know, they finally came undone. I had to, you know, finally start tying my own ties.
But also that seems like in conflict to my image of the 70s and the hippies and the flower children and all that.
Yeah.
Like, that seems like strange that they would do that.
Yeah. Well, they wanted to sell this to corporate America. And the people who had joined and got involved in the 60s and early 70s were hippies. And they were trying to do a shift in image. I would say
that's where the money is too.
That's where the money is. You know, the Maharishi came to the West with no money, and I think his estate when he died was close to $10 billion. So it's, you know, when you sell meaningless sounds, magic words for a business, you don't have any inventory problems, and you can endlessly come up with new product. You should come up with new magic words that people teach.
That's the word salad.
Yeah. I went to the university, which is an accredited university through the PhD level now. And it was a unique kind of education in that you took one course at a time. So physics was for a month, marketing was for a month, finance was for a month. But that was 6 days a week. So you were in class 6 days a week, from early in the morning till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the professors that they brought in were from major universities. So my finance professor came from Harvard. The physics professor came from CERN in Switzerland. So academically, it was an interesting environment. But after every 2 or 3 months of academics, you did something called a Forest Academy. And this is when you disconnected from the world. You didn't call home, write letters, do any of those things. You were assigned to a buddy that was always with you. And you increase the amount of meditation significantly. And you listen to tapes of Maharishi for a month. And it would be a month on a theme, one subject. And I remember after the theme of the first one was called the philosophy of action. It doesn't mean much. But if you became enlightened, everything you would do would be correct spontaneously. You would choose the spontaneous and right toothpaste. If somebody was drowning, you would take the path of least action, which you run down the beach 10 yards and then swim out. Everything would be spontaneously right. So it's all over and over again at the end of that. So the conclusion that I came to was, well, Maharishi's enlightened, so thus everything he says is right. And that's when the hook really got in, because you changed. He became not just this guy who was teaching things, but he became a perfect person. He became a god.
Right.
He became a god. to us. But another year into this, he introduced these powers, the supernormal powers program called the TM City program, where you learn to levitate, walk through walls, become invisible, you know, think of any power you want. And they taught them. And so that course involved doing this thing where you're isolated, that I just described, but for 3 months.
Wow.
And during that, they really wanted you to know how special you were. For me, being in a group often is like being in a prison of specialness. And so they really wanted to keep you tied into how special you were. So we all had badges with our pictures on them. And to get into the classroom, there would be two people at a door, at a vestibule, who were your friends that you knew. And you'd hold your badge up and they'd have to verify who you were. And then you'd go through a second set of doors where they'd verify again that you were you. And then you would sit down in rows and the first person in the row would have to check everyone's badge and to make sure that they were who they are. And then these people would come around with books. But they had six pictures, there were six people in every row, and they would check the books to make sure we were who we were. And they did that four times. So we knew that we were a very special elite group of people that were being taught these special powers that no one else has ever learned in the West. And that was specifically to levitate and fly.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. Did you ever levitate or fly?
So my experience is I did. Objectively, I didn't. Internally, I did. I have memories of flying and I have memories of people flying, seeing people fly in big rooms. But I know people don't levitate. So I have false memories of events.
Mm. How did that come to be? Like you wanted to believe it?
Well, it's such a powerful internal experience.
Right.
So, you know, you're here. We're in this course for 2.5 months. Of being sort of isolated. And the day comes where this videotape comes on and Margie said, so you want to learn to fly. And you're like, yeah, you know, we're learning the secret formula. And he gave us the secret formula that you were to do. So the secret formula was that every 15 seconds, you know, this is a very expensive thing, I'm going to tell you. It's about $5,000.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks for the bonus.
Yeah. So you mentally repeat the phrase, relationship of body and akasha, pause, lightness of cotton fiber. Every 15 seconds, and you're supposed to fly. So we were all told this, and there was about 300 people on the course. And we went back to our dorms, which now had rooms covered in foam rubber. And we sat down to do this, and nothing happened. And after a half hour, I think we went back to the large group, and they asked how many people who had gotten off started flying. There would be people who, you know, started flying. So we named our dorm Daedalus Air Force Base because we knew we were going to fly. And we're thinking, why is it that this jerk took off and it didn't happen to us? And then you start thinking, oh my God, I ate pizza one night. There was one night that I didn't go to bed at 10. I went at 10:01. So you started reviewing all the things that you had broken the rules on. And that really was depressing. But about 3 days of doing this, I was sitting on one side of a room that was maybe 40 feet across. And all of a sudden, I felt bolts of lightning going through my body. I started shaking violently. I started screaming, like cross between The Exorcist and The Body Snatchers. And my body just started going. The next thing I know, I hit the wall on the other side of the room. And my experience was I zoomed through the room. So the internal world, the internal experience becomes the standard, the measure, the yardstick of how you determine what's real or what's not real, what's accurate or not.
Right.
So that was so powerful, that cathartic experience, mm-hmm. that hooked me.
Wow.
You're in a room of people that are having similar experiences. Is that right?
Well, in theory, there were people who were not having those experiences, and they were really right. pissed off because we were screaming and yelling and we were disturbing their meditation. But yes, people would be flying into each other. They established lanes that you flew in. So you're hopping around like a frog. Because my internal experience was that I zoomed across the air, that's what I remembered. After a month or two of doing this, it became less and less spontaneous and less real to me. And then Jonestown happened.
Mm.
And that freaked me out because I'm like, now what's that about? So I started reading about cults, and I was like, okay, are we a cult? So there was a book called Snapping, and it described qualities of a cult. There's sleep deprivation. Well, we don't have that because you had to go to bed at 10. You had to have 8 hours sleep. Sugar, they talked about, and food. Well, we didn't have that. We had gourmet vegetarian food. I mean, it went point by point. I was going, well, we're not that. What I was missing was that all of those techniques are techniques that or approaches, the strategies for people to lose their critical thinking abilities. And so TM did it in a different way. They used essentially a form of hypnosis, which gets you to focus on an idea or attention to a point, and peripheral things go away and critical thinking disappears. So ideas come in and they go to feeling. And so feeling becomes the measure of reality. So that got me really trying to figure out, well, we weren't that. But the Moonies were that. So I went to New York City. A friend of mine had a plane. So we flew from Fairfield, Iowa to MacArthur Airport on a break. And I went into New York City and I hung out in front of the Mooney headquarters. And I went through their training 3 times because I was trying to figure out, well, how is it that people get, they're brainwashed. I'm not. I just couldn't put this together.
Interesting.
But I really wanted to figure it out, what was real and what wasn't real.
Why were you motivated to figure that out?
Jonestown.
Okay.
You know, the mass suicide and murder was part of it. And there were things that didn't always add up.
Okay.
And those things you sort of shelve.
Yes. Yeah, we know about the shelve metaphor.
Sarah's favorite metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah. So you put them aside.
Yeah.
You're taught that when you're on these long courses, that any thought that you have that is negative is a sign that your body is releasing stress from your past life. So right. if I think, oh, I hate this place, I can't stand it. Well, that is just, I'm unstressing. I'm relieving stress. And my buddy's job is to remind me, you're just unstressing.
Mm-hmm.
So someone was always there to remind you that any of your doubts were just that.
Right.
Seems like every cult has a reason for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It has a kind of, well, it's supposed to happen. You're doing it right kind of thing.
You're doing it right. And so you were on the program. Yeah. OT on the path.
Yeah.
On the program. That's what it was called.
OTP.
OTP. Yep. And that's what I heard it all the time. And at one point, I applied for a course in Switzerland, a very advanced course, and I was not accepted because they said in my records, I had worn blue jeans one day. I'm like, well, it's not possible because I don't own blue jeans because we're not allowed to have blue jeans. That they said, well, just because the thought came up in the environment, just because someone thought you did was an indication that you had a weakness somewhere in your nervous system.
Oh my God.
So just somebody else's thought, because an invincible person, you would not, people could not think a negative thought about you.
Right.
So that was that, you know, that's sort of a big,
that's like thought. A supreme gaslighting. Like,
somebody had thought. Yep. It's my fault.
Now that you're this expert and you have all this experience, what were some of the other red flags that you shelved along the way? There were inconsistencies that didn't sit right with you.
When you live in a university and for 5-year experience, there was professors that sometimes I just thought were off. Mm-hmm. There was some things that in the academics where they would shift, you know, so you study psychology, it was psychology and Maharishi's theory called the science of creative intelligence. And in Maharishi's theory would tell you where Freud was wrong. And so it's physics. And Maharishi's theory would tell you where the physics was right or wrong. And I came across, there was uncomfortable things that happened. One was we're going to become immortal. And that was one of the qualities. And that was a really great thing. They announced that immortality was possible. And they pulled all the men into this, it was called the Learning Center, a room and with a psychologist and another somebody, maybe the dean of students. And Maharishi had a special message for us that we could become immortal. And that was a great, you know, there it is. But with one caveat.
What's that?
You could have never had an ejaculation.
Oh, Oh, Jesus.
So the room, so you got all these guys who are like 18 years old to 25, and everybody's like, you know, we're stuck. We're screwed. But we could live a long time. So then that started this idea that you should be celibate. These little things just sort of creeped in that just didn't seem to add up. But the one of the key things, and it's going to seem very odd, but the student government had bought a nice sound system for the student union for dances, and it got stolen. And I believed so much, so I went to the dean of students, and there was this group. There's a hierarchy in TM, similar to the SASHes, but it's a different version of that, and NXIVM. So I went to this guy who was the dean of students, and I said, Dennis, do you think that the Council of Executive Governors, they're called, who all had these supernormal powers, one is to find things that are lost or hidden, could find it? Because, you know, we spent all this money. And he just looked at me with this weird look, like, and that stuck with me.
Good. Planted a little seed.
Yeah, something just like, if we're gonna can't find the lost or hidden things that belong to the Maharishi, what good is his power? So, you know, there's also this hierarchy. So there's meditators, and then there's checkers. This is the next level up. There are initiators, associate teachers, governors, executive governors, ministers. Then there's atoms. And then you get up to the top where now they're actually kings and queens.
Wow.
That are brought around in white horses and carriages.
Like a gold sash.
It's craziness at this point. But there was a hierarchy. And at some point, they separated the people who were not at these upper levels in the dorms from their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that started getting weird because of the elitism of the status. If you were not in that level, you were nobody.
Right.
That kind of goes against the name of transcendental meditation, doesn't it?
It transcends all those things. So the doctrine is saying one thing, and it just wasn't, you know, playing out in reality.
That's a really good red flag. What was the thing that caused your shelf to collapse? What was the final straw for you?
The TM movement began producing a lot of research showing that people who levitated together in groups could stop lower crime rate, raise stock markets, stop wars. And they believed it enough that they sent people into war zones in Nicaragua, Mozambique, Iran, into hotels covered in foam rubber. People are doing this levitation technique for hours and hours a day to stop wars. And then they produce this research that they could stop wars. So Maharishi then encouraged us to move into cities and to create villages. So I moved to Philadelphia and moved onto a street, which was not a nice street. I bought a few houses. They were $7,000. That was the most expensive one. There was a lot of them that were a dollar. And then when my parents came to visit me, and as soon as they got home, my sister called me and said, where do you live? And I said, I live in a bad area. I said, why? She said, because when we asked mom what your neighborhood was like, all she would say is, he's happy. So we lived in this community. In that community, there's just one other thing that happened is one of the TM teachers, who's a physician, reported me for burning the wrong kind of incense in my house. A brand of incense that was associated with a different guru that could keep you from evolving. A stick of incense.
Wow.
So I was living in this TM community, my business for all TM people. I worked for TM people. We had concessions in Sears and Penny stores selling Austrian crystal. And so we had all these stores, and it was all big, all connected to people I went to college with. And my dad called me one day. I have four older sisters, and said that one of my sisters had joined a cult, and he was upset. And he said, I think you can talk to her. I'm like, Dad, she's a crazy Christian nut. And your son is an outstanding Hindu businessman. I mean, I can't talk to her because she's crazy. And he said, look, Pat, I've supported you in everything you've ever wanted to do in your life, including you going to the Maharishi University. I paid for it. It was $30,000 in the 70s. I'm asking you to come talk to your sister. So a little guilt manipulation on dad's part. So I went to Florida. He said, there's about five books. You need to do a real quick catch up on this group called The Way International. And he said, in there, there's some criticisms of the Maharishi. So don't read those chapters. I drew lines through those chapters because we don't believe what they're saying. And so I read the books, and I convinced my sister to come back with me to meet somebody who had been in the group The Way. And so in my living room, this woman came. Her name is Lois Patton, who I never met. But I said to my sister, this is my friend Lois, I talked to her on the phone. And Lois sat down and started talking to my sister about cults, so to speak, and how influence work. behavior modification, those types of things. And as she was talking to my sister, I was going in my head, oh my God, this is exactly what they did to me. And as they went through this step by step, I was seeing the parallels, that it was so much like what happened to me.
Wow.
So for the first time, I gave myself permission to ask the questions that I wasn't supposed to ask. You know, there were acceptable questions and not acceptable questions.
Tell us some of those questions.
Like, what happened to my physics professor? Where did he go? He would be on videotapes with Maharishi and all, you'd see him. And then the next time you might see that videotape, there would be a flower, a rose, where that person was once. They'd been edited out. Mm. Dr. Bloomfield, Harold Bloomfield, was a TM teacher, and he'd written a number of books. And at one point at the university, he'd gotten involved in EST, and they took all of his books and put them in the dumpsters. So why? So I thought, in my sister's case, in the way people who had left were demonized, and this woman had sought them out to find out what their experience was. And so I did the same thing. And so I started seeking out these people to ask them what their experience was.
And how old were you?
22, 23.
This is 1980 by now?
82, maybe.
Okay.
One of them was one of Maharishi's closest aides. He was Maharishi's skin boy, somebody who carried Maharishi's deer skin that he sat on. He, you know, was gone. And because it was determined that he worked for the CIA. So at one point, people were in a huge room with Maharishi and this guy. And Maharishi pointed at him and said, go back and tell your controllers. Tell them everything you know. And then everyone goes, oh my God, he was a CIA agent. He was not trusted. So you couldn't trust anything he said. So when I talked to him, this guy, he had a honey farm in New Mexico. And he said, I believed Maharishi for all the years when he said this person worked for the CIA and then threw them out until the day came when he said I was in the CIA. And then I realized those other people weren't in the CIA either. Right. And so it was those stories that for me sort of put this together. So I went on one more course that was for 3 weeks long. It was 8,000 people flying together. It was called A Taste of Utopia in December of 1983. And then I'm looking around saying, this is all crazy. This is bullshit. No one's flying. They lied. So I asked for my money back for the flying program, which was $1,407. Wow. And they said, no. I said, I'm not asking for my money back for the university curriculum. It's just that you knew people couldn't fly. You had Nobel Prize winners. One is Brian Josephson, who got the Nobel Prize in physics in 64 for tunneling. You got these people standing up saying that they were levitating. You have all of these respected people saying that they did it and it worked, but it's not true. You're lying. And I just want my money back. And their response was, if you want your money back, sue us. So I did.
Nice.
Yes. Pat Ryan.
I filed a lawsuit in federal court in Washington for fraud and for negligence, myself and a number of other people. And we formed an organization called TMX, which this was before the internet, so that people could find out, here's some behind the scenes stories. And the lawsuit was a eye opener. Here we are, middle class kids that are college educated from middle class families who have to go before a jury of our peers in Washington, D.C. and tell them, you know, we thought we could levitate. And, sure. And why would they give you your money back? Like, you crazy kids. How could you believe this?
Right.
So we had to learn to articulate.
Right. Exactly.
And we had to have experts. So my experts were Dr. Jolly West and Margaret Singer.
You've met Margaret Singer?
She was one of my experts. So I remember I was out in Berkeley and she was doing these lengthy interviews ready for a deposition. And she was trying to tell me that maybe I'd been hypnotized and I had a vulnerability to hypnosis. And I was trying to explain to Margaret that that's not possible because the first research on TM is that in hypnosis, your metabolic rate goes up and in TM, it goes down. So it's not the case. She said, okay. So she said to me, how would you like, if I was going to hypnotize you, what do you think I would do? And I said, I really don't know. And so she started telling me a story. And somehow I ended up on the floor and the doorbell rang and Joe Zimhart, who interviewed you for your book, was out the door because we were out there together. Joe said, what happened to Pat? Why is he on the floor? She says, oh, he thought he couldn't be hypnotized. And I just wanted to show him he could. So wow. Margaret really, she needed to, in some visceral way, show me the vulnerability that I had developed of going to dissociative states from practicing meditation for so long. In the five-year period, I spent 18 months with my eyes closed, about 22 hours a day in month and three-month-long blocks.
That's wild.
It's a lot of meditation. Yeah.
For sure.
Just for our listeners, because I know that as I was leaving NXIVM, I to wrap my head around that we'd been hypnotized. And I think for many people, myself included, was like, no. But then as I did more education, self-education and talking to different experts, I realized that for sure we had. But I don't think that I or many people really know what that means. Like they think of hypnosis.
It's a big umbrella.
The big umbrella. Yeah. Can you just like break that down a little bit?
Yeah. Big umbrella is a good term because I think the term hypnosis is more descriptive of a whole host of techniques for bringing someone into a suggestible state of focused attention. So technically the word is called trance, and trance, by trance, we don't mean that you're not thinking or what's going on, but your attention is so focused on one idea at the expense of things that are going around you. So if you're a person who reads a book and you're so absorbed in the book that when someone comes in the room, you're not aware that they came in the room, you're in a level of trance. The thing about when you go into this focused awareness, what they found is that the period after you go into that focused awareness, that's when the person is most suggestible. That's when the information that they take in comes in without the normal filters. And so it goes information down, feeling.
I see.
So there are so many styles of hypnosis. The TM main technique that they use is called fractionation, which means to break the stuff up into little pieces. So you have somebody experience something, and then you add something, and then you add something else, and you add something else. So the instruction would be in TM, let's close our eyes. Let's open our eyes. Let's close our eyes. As a teacher, I would say when we close our eyes, naturally we feel some quietness, some silence, yes, with this little lilt at the end. And so the person is going to agree that they experience silence or they don't. And if they don't, we just keep on taking them through until they have experienced silence, that their mind settles down a little bit. And then the next thing we want to establish is that they have thoughts in the quietness. And so you ask them, you know, did you feel some thoughts? Or did you come in the quietness? And then you get them to say yes. So you've broken it up into little pieces.
Right.
And then you begin putting them into first about a 30-second meditation, then a 3-minute meditation, then a 10-minute meditation. And at the end of doing this process, then you use embedded commands. So you begin saying these rehearsed statements that say that this is how you'll do this at morning and evening. You start embedding the commands, what you're supposed to do with the person. So that's how TM does it. Different people do it in different ways. So chanting, meditation, guided imagery, trance dancing, all of these things put people into a suggestible state of mind. And interesting thing, I'll just real quickly, is that suggestibility and creativity go hand in hand. So it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
I guess that's the origin of my next question. Like when you think of the architect of this whole thing, do you think someone sits down and goes, okay, here's what I'm up to. I'm out to get these people, or the origin of it is started as altruistic and someone recognizes they can manipulate people? Because that's a pretty specific process you just laid out. And I'm just wondering if like someone's up there with a clipboard years ago going, here's how this is going to work. Try and trust it. Like, what's the origin?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And that's a question I don't think I have the full answer to. There's a group on Facebook called The Roots of TM from people who were in very early on. And one could come to the conclusion that Maharishi, you know, his motivations were to teach the world his form of spirituality. But he encountered people in the West that were different. He also had a big respect for L. Ron Hubbard. There's a tape that we would listen to called A Consideration of Other Systems, where people would say, basically, you're in a room, and they say, Maharishi would say, well, I was in Est. And then Maharishi would explain why Est was wrong. It's a consideration, and why TM was right. And when he got to Scientology, he said that if L. Ron Hubbard was in the TM movement, the Age of Enlightenment would have dawned because of his organizational skills. So some of these processes that are taught that were structured have some Scientological qualities in terms of the structure. Mainly when he went from people to becoming teacher training with maybe 30 people on a course to like a 500 or 1500 or 2000, then it became highly structured. And virtually everything when you're in the train is memorized verbatim. So the process of teaching someone is 30 pages long. You have to memorize every single word verbatim, down to the lilts at the end of sentences and the spacing seconds between words. And so you learn this whole process and you do it to yourself and you do it to other people. So did Maharishi, I mean, I think at some point he started just like taking his culture and dicing it up into little pieces and selling little pieces of it to us.
Because if you're in the room with athletes who want to get better, you've reached it. You said it's in, I don't know, 4 or 5 states where it was, quote, would you say is a sanitized version of it? So there's enough there that where there's other systems in place that are going, let's use this, let's use this, let's use this. There's good things there. Right. What did Maharishi do with it?
Well, I think that at some point when he started adding these add-ons, and the add-ons were endless, from rooftop adornments to architecture. You had to tear down your house if your door doesn't face east to enter your house. And they have an architecture company to potions and herbs and every kind of thing. It's his own medicine system, you know, cautioned against going to Western doctors, even if they were in the TM movement. As time went on, he just began selling pieces and more pieces.
So he commercialized.
He commercialized it up until the point where you paid $1 million to become a king.
Yeah.
It's the through lines that I'm seeing, because for our listeners who have followed us from the beginning, we're really trying to lay out what are the processes that are abusive. What I'm hearing is like it's never ending. You can't take a course, graduate from, put it in your life and move on. And that's a real distinction for us, is like, when does something become your whole life and it never ends and you're constantly paying and you're never enough. And yeah, that's obviously a major red flag. I realized I interrupted you and you didn't tell us what happened with the lawsuit. Did you win it or no?
Well, eventually we settled out of court. So the first lawsuit that occurred was in federal court in Washington, and the guy, Robert Kopinski, was awarded $138,000. And then the TM movement appealed it, and it went through a whole bunch of processes. And at some point, I settled with them.
Good.
They were grueling. I mean, depositions that would go on for days. They can ask you anything, and they can just rip yourself through. And all my friends are in college with, old girlfriends. I mean, it's just like all coming out. Ugh. And you have to answer their questions.
Are they pretty litigious in general?
They weren't then in the U.S. I think they have some of those qualities. But I lived in a TM community, so my neighbors were reporting to them about me.
Oh,
like,
man.
Who came to my house, when I left, what they were doing.
You got fair gamed.
I got fair gamed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. At what point did you decide to get involved in interventions? And would like to know a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that was not my plan. I guess the first intervention was my sister while I was still in the group. I structured that. I had this gift company, and I was at a Minneapolis gift show, and I'm selling trinkets and jewelry, and I had to sell $250,000 this weekend. And it was in the same convention center, there was a seminar going on to train Christian healers. So there were people touching people and they're falling down. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I just left my booth and I was in there like, why are these people, what's making this work? And my interest was like, how does that work? I mean, I asked this guy, do you want to buy my company? I just can't stand doing this anymore. What's interesting to me is how people experience what they experience. Mm-hmm. How can you induce these kinds of experiences like that I had with flying, or these people being touched on the head and falling down? That started driving the desire. And then families started calling me and saying, you know, my kid is in TM, we talked to them. And it just kept on snowballing.
And you're still doing that. You're still helping families.
Yeah, it's like, here we are. It was from 1983 to now.
Wow.
I've been doing this full time.
Pat mentioned, I know you can't say names, but I know you've helped some families with ex-Nexium members. And I'm just wondering, now that we're doing this research and doing the podcast, I'm like, it's such a template. Like, I see it's the same thing over and over again, slightly different practices and traditions or rituals or whatever, but it's the same processes of abuse. What did you see when you first found out about students of Nexium? Like, what were some of the observations you had?
I mean, I always tried to find the lineage of a group and trace it back to where did the ideas come from? So if we're looking at any different types of groups, you might trace it back to the first century. These ideas are not new.
Right.
There's nothing really new under the sun.
So where did Keith steal from? Where did he?
There was a lot of Scientological type processes. There's the EST kind of qualities of large group awareness trainings. You have the multi-level marketing of something called Holiday Magic, which was a multi-level marketing program in the 60s. So you look and trace them back, because that's what's curious. Like, how did this person put this together? Where did, you know, how did they cobble this together? So the one thing is, I think that these techniques and being involved in groups are not necessarily the worst thing in the world. I think that people improve in their lives in some areas, and they can get caught in that improvement process. So, you know, both are true. So my mom meditated till she died because it lowered her blood pressure. And so when I would go visit her, she would say, "Pat, will you check my meditation?" And here I am, I sued the Maharishi. I'm like, "Let's close your eyes. Let's open your eyes to mom." Because I think that people wouldn't be in groups if they weren't getting something out of it.
Of course, yeah.
But at the same time, there's this stickiness that you get stuck in, this web, and in this prison of specialness we fall into. And when you start, you know, thinking you're part of the elite, your people are going to change the world, you'll put up with just about anything. So if you look at TM, there's about 10 million people have learned. There's probably only about 50,000 that were teachers in the inner core. And, you know, if you really get it down to probably now there's 5,000 people that are like, like I was describing my involvement. Most of the people are much more casual about it. And so in terms of Nexium, I saw the same thing. I saw people that took courses and they got something out of it, and that was, they put it behind them. And then I saw people who it took over their lives. And I think both are true. And many people don't like to acknowledge that there are positive experiences for people. So like I can get from Philadelphia to LA in a Volkswagen, a Tesla, a Learjet. In all cases, I get to California. Some are easier, more comfortable. Some are not as comfortable. And so I think that people change, and they change in many cases for the better. I think that a sizable minority of people that have been in groups are harmed. And those are the ones that we interact with, are the people who are harmed. We're not dealing with the people who, you know, they did it, they moved on. So in my family, three sisters, like eight nephews, I mean, they all learned TM. It was nothing to them. They paid too much. They went through, a bunch of BS, but
they weren't hurt. And they had tools.
They had tools.
Like, that's something that Nippy and I really come to terms with. We haven't been the type to say, throw the baby out with the bathwater, which is a terrible saying. But, you know, that we wanted to find what was good in it. A, because we, you know, I spent, 12 years, Nippy 16 years. We wanted to not throw all that out and say, where are these tools from? Where do they come from originally? So we don't have to be like, thank you, Vanguard, every time we, use a tool.
Right.
And at the same time, we're trying to show what are those good things, so that people can use them in their life, but not have to join a group that has the potential to be destructive. But the problem is when you continue down the pipeline and you, you know, move, in our case, move to Albany or join his harem of women and or whatever, that's when the destruction happens. But you have to know what those good things look like on the outside. And can I tell you my TM story now?
Yeah.
Long story short, one of the big first public interviews I did, and it's before the vow, we were being interviewed by, you know, quite a famous journalist. I'm not going to say her name, but she was there and she was interviewing Yanya Lalich and myself and four members of other groups. And it was a break. The cameras were off and we were just chit-chatting, waiting for the next setup. And she said, and the whole tone of the interview was, she was truly was trying to, like many journalists, I'm sure you know, going, "So why do people join cults? What is the allure? You know, how do they get sucked in? How do smart people, you know," and that was the vibe. And on a break, she said, "So what are you all doing now? Like, what do you do now for your rituals or whatever?" And I go, "You know, I drink green juice and I go to yoga, but I'm not part of a yoga group." And this woman, the journalist said, yeah. "I mean, I drink my red wine and I do my TM." And Yanya and I look at each other and we're like, "That's a cult. TM is a cult." And she was like, no, it's not. My man, you know, and she was really defensive. And I thought, but I wish it'd been on camera, because it was such a good example of, she's just doing her mantra. Like, it's not going to hurt her. She's not going to try to, you know, invest all her money or, you know, go to the university or bounce off walls or whatever. Like, it's benign, right? Or is it not? Tell me.
Well, I mean, if I can say a name, if it's okay. I think you're talking about Elizabeth Vargas.
I am.
Because I know. And so TM uses her.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
She's part of the fundraising to teach TM in schools. Well,
then I have a different opinion.
So
I have a different opinion now.
No.
Oh, yeah. Well, that whole Good Morning America crew, Stephanopoulos. I mean, that whole crew does TM.
And they use her as to, like, look who's doing TM. And okay.
Ivanka Trump.
Oh, my God.
They sell these people on the idea that, you know, there are inner city schools that these kids need this stress release, and they help raise all this money, which, interestingly enough, you know, you raise the money, TM movements charging the teachers to teach. It's a franchise system in a sense. And then that money, part of it eventually makes it to India. And Maharishi's family supports the party in India, the JPG, that is the one that is persecuting Christians and Muslims. So here we are, we're talking about all peace, but the money ends up in India, a piece of that.
Okay. Okay. So the irony of Elizabeth
Vargas. That story changes now.
This is amazing. The irony of Elizabeth Vargas sitting there grilling me about how do people join cults? What is the allure? Yeah, just like you just said, Elizabeth. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. There's a funny story about how people join cults. So I live in Philly, and next to me was a barbershop. Not that I frequented it that much, but there was a barbershop. And I was over there one day, and the assistant mayor was getting his hair cut. And the John the barber said, Pat, tell him what you do. And I'm like, I just don't want to go down this route. So I started explaining to him, you know, I work with people who have been influenced in different ways. And he said, oh, that could never happen to me. And I said, yeah, I know. Most people said that. Mm-hmm. Conversation went on. And I said, you know, we're actually having a meeting at our house tonight. It's $50. We're giving a talk, but, you know, you're welcome to come. And he took all the information down. And then as I walked out the door, I said, that's how it's done. There is no meeting next door.
Mm-hmm. You just signed up for the first thing.
You took the bait because the barber said, Pat's okay. And I said, you don't know who the hell I am, right. But you took the bait. And so that's taking that first step.
Right.
And I think we all do it all the time. You were describing something before that this keeps coming in my mind. It's this escalator of commitment. And
yes.
I think that groups put you on the escalator of commitment.
Yeah. Keith called it lifts, the lifts.
The lift. Yeah.
That should be a red flag.
Yeah.
For anybody. At the beginning of this, I messaged a girlfriend who's from LA and she's an actress and she has been very supportive of my journey, never joined NXIVM. I never did a hard sell on her, thank goodness. So we have a very pristine relationship, which is rare for me. But I said, hey, I'm doing an episode on, she loves the pod, an episode on TM. Do you have any questions? Because when this all came out, she shared with me that she did the basic course and has a mantra, and it was very private and helpful. And then she didn't do anything else. And that was it.
Yeah.
But she has heard crazy shit. Mm-hmm. I just said to her, like, just so you understand, I'm not going to say her name. That is like what you said with your friend at the barbershop. You did the first lift. You're on the first escalator. You didn't get hurt. Good for you.
Yeah.
You know, mazel tov.
And you might have got something out of it. Mm-hmm. You might have felt more relaxed. You learned to dissociate a little bit. See, the thing with meditation is weird, that most meditation research on the value of meditation has been done by the TM movement or TM movement affiliated researchers. So you'll see research studies that are compared to Harvard, Yale, Princeton. And if I look at them, I go, well, I went to school with that person. That there are TM movement, they're in the group, they're doing the research. So they only show you the positive effects. The fact is that in a number of studies indicate that about 40% of the people who practice meditation develop psychological problems. They have difficulties. So 60% do really well and 40% don't do so well. And the phenomenon is called relaxation-induced anxiety. So I have this. So I was the kind of person that when I would sit and meditate, I would flow crazy. You know, I just was not made to sit still.
Me neither.
Me neither, dude.
It was horrible. There's a video I sent you of me that one of my colleagues calls spiritual Botox because you see, I'm an animated person. Nothing moves when I'm talking except my mouth. I mean, it's like so still. So one of the things that Margaret Singer pointed out to me is that, you know, you're just wired differently. You need active relaxation. Go lift weights. Pick up a thing and lift. Do something that's integrating for you. But for other people, it's not. So that's what the research. There's Borvik and Hyde from the University of Kansas. There's a number of studies that indicate this about meditation in general. There's a lot of project right now in Brown on the adverse effects.
Ah, that's one.
On mindfulness. Mm-hmm. But in TM, in these teaching procedures, we had procedures to deal with people's problems that they had in meditation. So we had procedures if somebody had uncontrolled thinking or obsessive thoughts. So if we had a procedure to deal with obsessive thoughts, then obviously people have obsessive thoughts in meditation. We had a procedure to deal with people who started violently, their body started shaking when they meditated. So you don't have procedures for things that are not problems. So, but we had reasons why they did it. We had to spiritualize. We spiritualized it.
It wasn't the process. It was something in them that made the process not work.
The process is pure.
I have a question. It's personal what you just said. Like, I can't really sit, but like a long car ride by myself, sometimes I feel like I go into like an internal kind of meditation, although I'm driving. But when I lift weights, to your point, what you just said, I totally relate to, because I'll get into a state, and while I'm doing something, like whatever it is, the pump or whatever it is you want to call it, gets me kind of into like a meditative, deep, relaxed state while I'm doing something physical to my body.
For me, it's yoga.
Yeah. Well, so there's active relaxation, and then there's these passive relaxation. And Margaret Singer described it, she's passed away, as that for people like me who have this, I'm in that category, it's that the lid on the subconscious gets lifted, and then you have emotional flooding. All this stuff going on and on, and it just happens. So when you have emotional flooding, that's not the way to handle your stress. Maybe using active relaxation, like lifting weights, and avoiding things, Margaret said, like Stairmaster, running, spinning, biking, because all these things are trance-inducing. So if you have this tendency to go into these dissociative states, those things can encourage.
Well, that makes sense why spin has been so popular then for people. Yeah. It's the trance of this era. Wow, that makes a lot of sense, ain't it?
Yeah.
It does. That's really helpful to hear that, because I always thought like I couldn't meditate. Yeah. Maybe I can.
You can, because in TM, anything that happens, if you're uncomfortable, that's just part of the process. You're doing it right because you're uncomfortable.
Hey there. Hope you're enjoying the episode. Quick reminder to follow us on Instagram. You can also share your favorite episodes with friends who may or may not be in a cult. And also reach out to us to let us know who you would love to hear as a guest. And now, a word from our sponsors.
That was the big thing in reading your story, too. I mean, you hurt yourself at one point because you were doing, were you hopping for like 2 hours a day or something like that?
We were hopping, more than that, yeah.
And they were like, do more of it because you're doing, that's part of the process?
When you're on a course, you had to do the program. And if you didn't do the program, you were kicked off. And it was crazy. I mean, I don't know how to explain the craziness of it. I remember this thing I mentioned earlier that you had to be in bed at 10 o'clock. So if you went to bed at 9:59 and had to go to the bathroom and went to the bathroom at 10, you were labeled red on their system. But if you were in bed at 10 and went to the bathroom at 10:01, you were green. You had to be in bed at 10. So it's just this, the minutia of control. And so if the flying period is a half hour, two in the morning and two in the afternoon, you have to be there and you can't not do it. Or you can't advance. You know, you're tossed off the escalator of commitment.
Yeah, that puts a lot of fear into people.
It does. It's a fear of you're going to lose your salvation.
Right.
You know, we were taught that there's 3.5 billion lifetimes you go through from being a spark to becoming a god. But it's only in the human nervous system that we have this unique ability that we can transcend that and become God. Mm-hmm. And it's only in this unique time. So the expression was to not get enlightened in this lifetime. It's like selling a diamond for the price of spinach. It's just you've wasted your life.
Poor spinach.
Obviously, you're sensitive to these symptoms now. What do you see in our culture right now that kind of you see have red flags? What are the big ones that you kind of go, oh?
There's a normalization, you know, more and more of these kinds of practices. Mm-hmm. I think that's really what's happened. It's normalized. The things that they did in NXIVM are not that far off that happen in corporate trainings.
Oh, no, totally. Except for branding people.
Yeah.
Pat, to your point, in 2003, and this is something I've forgotten, I haven't really talked in any of our podcasts. In 2003, right after the Enron scandal, there's a CEO named Stephen Cooper who took over as the new interim CEO of Enron after it happened. We took his staff of like 30 through one of our five-day trainings. In 2003, to your point, it had been normalized.
Yes.
Granted, Sashes and Vanguard weren't used in that training.
Yes. A cleaned up version.
Yes. Yes. A corporate version.
Sanitized version of what's going on. And I think that that's what's happened. The thing is that people change in these kinds of programs. They evolve. Mm-hmm. And that evolution is helpful to many people. Mm-hmm. But our society, it's so normalized. And I sit on my corner in downtown Philadelphia, and people come by, we're chatting, having a glass of wine, and I just hear person after person who's in some group, or in they bought into these, you know, alternative ideas that they're inherently, there's nothing wrong with. I mean, I think about Eastern spirituality a lot. We don't have the filters. We don't catch the cues that there's something screwed up. You know, if I turn on TV or you turn on the TV and you see a televangelist, you know, you go, okay, this is ridiculous, right? your BS meter goes off. We don't have the cues for Hindu televangelists. And that's what you see of these gurus who are coming from the East. They're like Hindu TV evangelists, but we don't have the cultural filters to go, oh, something wrong there. And the same thing in the large group awareness training industry, which I would say that NXIVM comes from, those group processes have been normalized in corporate America. And corporate America is just looking at the bottom line. And mm-hmm. if somebody's productivity mm-hmm. increases, or they're no longer hung up on, I don't know, their anger at their boss because they went through a training. Right. Well, that's what we want you to do. And they become fertile recruiting grounds for people.
Do you think there's a space for healthy personal development for the corporate culture or for the world where like a large group where people are getting more aware, where it's not corrupt or abusive?
Well, I would answer this in a slightly different way by reframing your question.
Please.
About what Margaret Singer expressed. And what she expressed, she said that the large group awareness trainings are applying psychotherapeutic technique evenly to a group of people. There's 300 people in a room, 50 people in a room, whatever it is. It's the same technique is being applied evenly. Where she said, as a therapist, if I started using a particular technique and I saw someone's not reacting, I would switch to something else.
Right.
But when you're applying the same thing to everyone, you're assuming that everyone is the same.
Right.
That you have the right. And that's where I think the problem comes.
And it's not safe.
That's not safe.
Yeah.
Margaret said it's a bell curve. You've got the, you know, people in the middle that, you got somebody one standard deviation to one side and they're doing great. And you got the next one on the other side not doing as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you get the people out here, you know, from the bell, and they're like doing fantastic. This is life transformation for them. And then you have the people who end up in hospitals.
Right.
And you have it all. But the people who are offering those are not filtering people. So they're not doing the things that I think that are important to do. Because we know that people have vulnerabilities. And I know in TM, we knew that people have vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
And there's people that shouldn't have been taken up the ladder. But when, you know, you can make $5,000, well, you're going to go up the ladder. And so, and I think that we all who've been in groups did that not because we're bad people. We did it really because we believed and we think we were helping people. Yep. It'd be like a Christian saying Jesus is not good for some people. It's not going to happen. But in the improvement industry, sometimes this version of, so to speak, Jesus is not good for everyone.
I think that's really important.
Yeah.
Right. That's why there's so many religions too.
Yeah.
Do you have something that really chaps your ass about TM that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, the things that at its core bother me are my friends who died.
Oh, yeah.
And so the people who really believed they could fly and they jumped off of buildings.
Oh, my God.
Just last month, two students that went to Maharishi, the primary school, killed their teacher, their Spanish teacher in the public school.
What?
The young man who was psychotic, that they let him go to the university and he got a knife and stabbed another student and killed him in the dining hall. Those are the things that bother me. And that continues, that's what bothers me. The kids who are raised in this system, you know, substance abusers, like a heroin addict's primary relationship is with the substance, not with your family or anyone else. Mm-hmm. That's your primary relationship. And when the primary relationship a parent has is with a guru, a teacher, a program, it's secondary for their kids. And so those kids, when the parents are in the domes flying for 2 hours, they're feral. They're not getting the nurturing that one deserves. And so for those kids, that really sort of pisses me off a lot.
Me too. That's not right.
How do you reel that in? How does that change?
In the TM organization, it's changed because people don't meditate as much as they used to. They've pulled a lot of these things way back that they did, just as they did in the S training. You know, at some point, the lawsuits got too many and they pulled the stuff back in terms of the more extreme practices. But when you believe that this is how you get off the planet, when you believe that this is how you're going to make the world a better place and you're sold on this, you give up everything. And there was one guy that I have interviewed. He gave, I think, $125 million to Maharishi to build a camp in India where people would be levitating enough people to stop the wars. And, you know, he was just taking advantage of it at his core. So it's that kind of like spiritual rape in some sense, that when they take your innocence, you know, it's hard. I mean, I'm 64, so it's hard to look at me as an innocent kid. But I think probably sent you some pictures when I was in, when I was a young little kid, you know, I was like, I was innocent to what they were doing.
Yep.
And, you know, you usurp that. And in a sense, you know, we all take those experiences, and people have had horrible experiences in life. Look, these are high-class problems we're talking about. You know, are living horrible lives. We're talking about, first-world problems.
Right.
But it hurts. And that's what, you know, we see when we help people in recovery.
Sounds like, you know, being an interventionist, an activist, an expert, what's your main healing path that you can impart? Because a lot of our listeners are ex-members or, you know, healing in different ways.
My work has changed over the years of doing interventions. You know, there were times where it was very important for me for someone to say they were in a cult. I mean, these things are not as important to me at this time. But it's to try to teach families that to love people who hold different ideas, how to stay connected with them, how to create a safe space for them to come out to, an easy glide path out to the outside world. Because if you don't create that, it's problematic. When I was in TM, we called TM the solution to all problems. And my mom had a heart attack. And I called her from school and said, "Mom, in the hospital, you have the solution to all problems, meditation, and you choose not to use it. So you choose to suffer. When you don't want to suffer anymore, you can end it." And I hung up. What a pompous ass, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, here I'm 18 years old or something like that. So when I left, it took me 3 years to tell my parents I left.
Wow.
Because I was too embarrassed.
Yeah.
And then they had to go through their own journey because they paid for me to do all this. And were they wrong?
Right.
So I think that showing people respect, and people deserve respect and dignity, is really important for people to help them recover. And I try to get families to come up with the things where they've made decisions, not based upon, you know, strict intellect. The friend that says invest in this stock, that they bought a property here. We can all come up with all kinds of things because a buddy told me to do that, that you don't go and check every detail.
Yes.
It happens.
Right. So developing that compassion and empathy for the person who is in the cult versus judging them, like, "Oh, I would never do that."
Helping people come to an honest understanding of the things that were good and the things that were good that had a high cost and the things that were problematic.
Right.
Because they all are accurate. I mean, they all exist.
That's really helpful. I think that's really helpful. I'd love to be, Nippy knows this, I obsess about trying to help the people who still remain loyal to Keith to help them wake up, but they don't see me as a trustworthy person anymore. So
the way you help them, I know.
But I'm saying, like, I'd love to create that welcome home. I won't judge you. I won't rub it in. I will just welcome you and give you a big hug. But I can't, you know.
Look, I was you. I was you. When I left and I was so angry at them, I went to the local TM center every Wednesday at the introductory lecture and with a picket sign for years. Everywhere I went in the world, because I did intervention, I'd be in Australia, I would pick at them. I was like I was so angry. And they didn't, none of those people wanted to talk to me because I was this horrible person. Maharishi labeled me the chief demon of the universe. So, I mean,
you look like a demon. You look like a demon.
You know, it's like, it's called the grossest form of the relative. It's in the TM language.
Yeah.
But there was a time when I backed off from that activism and that pushing, that people started coming. One of the things that I found is those friends that I had that were friends then when I was young, they're friends again. And
that's great.
My partner last week went out to dinner with two of his friends who are still in the TM movement. I mean, they still have a relationship.
That's good.
And it's that creating that not adversarial point helps. And, you know, unfortunately, you're probably in the same boat I am, but with Nexium, you know, you're at that point where people don't want to talk.
Yeah.
But they will.
I hope so.
I think.
I dream about
most people are coming around.
Yeah, we get calls like every couple of weeks, a month or so, people apologizing for not believing us.
Well, they just figure out that we weren't the villain.
Yeah. You know, it's hard for people, I think, to sort through that part of what's good and what's bad.
Yeah.
and the cost of what they got that was good.
Yeah.
And, you know, those are the exercises that I take families through, is to get them to empathize, you know, what is good about these things. Because when you only talk what's wrong, people don't want to be around you.
Mm-hmm. It's a negative inertia too. Yeah. It creates a toxicity.
It does. I'm not going to ever say there's not a problem, but I also can focus on the parts that are good so that we can have a real meaningful relationship.
That sounds great and super positive. We wanted to end on that positive note. And
it's a great one.
You're a real shining example of how to be on the other side of the path.
How to win.
Yeah, how to win and own it and fix it and teach it. And I really look up to you.
Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom.
You guys are doing amazing things.
Thank you.
Oh, he is such a wealth of information.
Yeah, I still think his name is like a major league pitcher's name.
Pat Ryan?
Like Patrick Ryan. He's 16-3 on the season with a 2.50 ERA. He's having his best season to date. He goes against the tough Milwaukee lineup that he struck out 10 times in his last outing, something like that.
That's good.
Yeah.
He actually reminded me of two things. My own chaps my ass about Nexium. He said the thing about the jeans, that they weren't allowed to wear jeans, and I totally forgot. When I first started in 2005 and became a coach, we weren't allowed to wear jeans because they weren't executive success. And I was like, in Vancouver, everybody wears like, okay, granted, not like jeans with holes, but like a nice dark denim jean with a blazer. And I fought for that. Do you remember? I fought for jeans to be allowed in the uniform for the coaches.
Well, that is kind of an old school kind of thing where no jeans, you know.
I know, but that's what I'm saying. They were behind the times. They were always behind.
But Keith rolled around in like 70s jumpsuits and shit. So it wasn't like...
More like a volleyball track.
Like I said in our first episode, he dressed like a dirty laundry bag.
And smelled like one too.
Yeah. Evidently,
and you
smell
like one too. And I got in trouble once from somebody who was giving me shit. Like I was wearing like a nice executive outfit. Really nice fancy theory blazer with dark denim jeans. And this was somebody who was giving me, basically telling me I wasn't executive of enough. And she was not wearing jeans, but she did not look success program at all. And I was upset. That was my chaps my ass. I was going to say the other thing he mentioned that I think was also true for us as a red flag. He said that he noticed that people were off. And I felt that a lot, especially when we were trying to go to the next level and become proctor. And I looked around and the people above me, and they all, not all of them, most of them were like, had certain elements that were really inspiring, obviously, like they were good teachers or they're good with the air quotes tech, but they like also had bizarre personal issues that made me think like you shouldn't be a facilitator or a proctor if you're, you know, smoking or bulimic or like not very nice. Like there's just people who wouldn't even like smile when you walk by. I mean, I was like, I thought we were building humanity.
The inconsistencies of the entire system were what was frustrating.
Yeah. And that's a red flag we want to pass on to our listeners.
Yeah.
Is it consistent? Is what they say the same thing as what they do? Okay. Did you have a word salad for me? The last word salad of 2021.
You know, Maharishi has quite the salad bar, if you will.
Oh, yeah?
When I went online.
Tell me some of them. Word salad.
If you're too busy to meditate twice a day, you're just too busy.
So profound.
No, but you know people in the room are like,
I'm just too busy. Yeah. I'm just too busy. Yeah.
Another one he has here is, we must take situations as they are. Thanks, buddy. I dropped 5K for that shit.
I love you. I love our listeners. I love this new job we created for ourselves.
Yeah,
thank you, guys.
I love the internet.
You love the internet? Really? Yeah. That's all? That's all you got? You love the internet?
I love the internet.
Hear that, folks? There's a lot of love in this family. A lot of reciprocal love. I love you, sweetheart. I love the internet. So that's it, guys. Thank you again for listening. Happy New Year to all of you. And see you in 2022. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped NXIVM, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.